Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Call it audacious, call it ominous, whatever you call it, the U.S. attack killing Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq may well prove consequential for years to come. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. took action because of a specific threat in the region.
This is a man who's put American lives at risk for an awfully long time, and last night was the time that we needed to strike to make sure that this imminent attack that he was working actively was disrupted.
Another incident of hate targeted Jews over the holidays. A machete-wielding attacker brutally slashed five people at an Orthodox rabbi's home during Hanukkah. Nikki Cohen is the daughter of one of the victims. Her father, Joseph Newman, was the most seriously injured. She made a passionate plea to stand up against hatred.
It cannot keep going on. We want our kids to go to school and feel safe. We want to go to our synagogues and feel safe. We want to go to groceries and malls and feel safe.
And many thousands flee raging wildfires off the coast of Australia. Hundreds of homes were destroyed and at least seven people were confirmed dead. Resident Jan Gilbert says she feels lucky that she and her animals survived. But she gave a stark appraisal of her circumstances.
All of my possessions have been totally incinerated. There is just simply nothing left. Nothing at all except that.
Join us. Later on this hour, we'll be talking about the Senate trial and politics surrounding impeachment. You can join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio as well. With us from Washington, D.C. is Susan Page. She's the chief Washington she's the head of the Washington Bureau for USA Today. Susan, thanks once more for being with us today.
Hey, David, it's great to be with you.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, David Ignatius. He's a foreign affairs columnist and author at The Washington Post. Thanks, David.
Happy to join you, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David. David and Susan.
So if we seem a little, hurly-purly today, it's because of the news that's played out overnight. I think it's, of course, important to note that what has happened in Iraq is an assassination. And it was one that was in some ways foretold. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper told reporters yesterday that the U.S. would take preemptive action if officials determined attacks by Iran were in the offing.
There are some indications out there that they may be planning additional attacks. That's nothing new, right? We've seen this for 2-3 months now. So if that happens, then we will act. And by the way, if we get word of attacks or some type of indication, we will take preemptive action as well to protect American forces, to protect American lives.
David Ignatius, I want to now play what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had to say about this. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the world is a safer place because the U.S. took action to kill Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. But while Pompeo says the world is safer, the State Department released a statement telling Americans in the region, specifically in Iraq, to get out and to get out right now. Here, Pompeo spoke on CNN.
What's different today is that Iran has now been engaged for months and we've managed dozens and dozens of attacks throughout the region. President Trump's shown enormous restraint to date. While we've made clear to the Iranians that we weren't going to tolerate the killing of Americans on December 27th, an American was killed in Iraq. And then we watched the intelligence flow in that talked about Soleimani's travels in the region and the work that he was doing to put Americans further at risk. And it was the time to take this action so that we could disrupt this plot, deter further aggression from Qasem Soleimani and the Iranian regime, as well as to attempt to de-escalate the situation. The risk of doing nothing was enormous. The intelligence community made that assessment, and President Trump acted decisively last night.
David Ignatius, you've covered questions of the U.S. relations with Iran in that region for decades, and national security concerns paramount among your areas of interest here. Can you give us a feel, listeners, a feel of the importance of Soleimani and also the implications of deciding to kill him, to intentionally decide to kill him as a result of some of the tensions and some of the incidents playing out in recent days and weeks in Iraq?
David, Qasem Soleimani, Haji Qasem, as people in the region sometimes called him, was a master player. He conducted brutal covert operations across the region. He used proxies with enormous skill. He spent time over decades with his key assets, cultivating them, moving them into position, empowering them. I think it's certainly right to say, as Secretary Pompeo did, that this was a dangerous man both to Americans and to people in the region who used power ruthlessly. It's also true that in dealing with Soleimani and Iran generally in this period of increasing tensions that began late spring, summer, President Trump generally has showed restraint. The Iranians shot down drones, attacked Saudi oil facilities. The U.S. didn't retaliate with the kind of military force that people may have expected. So that's also true. I think the difficulty for the U.S. has been trying to calibrate how to deter actions by Iran and the proxies that Soleimani managed, in particular the Shiite militias in Iraq, without bringing on a catastrophe that would put U.S. troops in greater risk. And I think we're still struggling with that issue. The U.S. took retaliatory action after one American contractor was killed a week ago. He was killed at a base near Kirkuk. The U.S. retaliated in a strike that killed 25 25 for one. It's a way of saying, you know, don't do this again. But the 25 were from an Iraqi Shia militia that is very close to Soleimani's operations. With this strike on Soleimani himself, obviously we don't know what's ahead, but I think we can be fairly confident that the Iranians will retaliate in some way at a time of their choosing. The final thing I'd say, David, is that there are constraints on the Iranians' ability to use power. Yes, we have a lot of American troops who are in Iraq who are vulnerable.
And more headed over.
But by the same token, significant additional deaths of Americans would bring a level of American response that I think Iran would be very reluctant to see. We're heading into an election, but Iran is in a pretty rocky political period itself. There have been mass protests in the streets since November 15. Estimates are that somewhere between 300 and 1,000 Iranians have been killed by their own government protesting the government. There have been protests across Iraq by Shiites who don't want Iranian tutelage. So it's a situation that has a lot of volatile trends and countertrends. Wise advice is to fasten your seatbelts. The one thing I would contest is this idea that the world is safer after last night's action. You'd have to say that it's more dangerous.
Susan Page, I'm looking at that security alert at the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. It says U.S. citizens should not approach the embassy, that citizens should depart Iraq immediately via airline while possible, and failing that, to other countries via land. You know, not necessarily the easiest thing to suggest. Susan Page, your reporting, the reporting of those who work for you in the Washington Bureau of USA Today, what does it reflect about the process by which this decision was reached?
You know, I think there are a lot of questions, David, about whether it was a sort of thoughtful process that we would hope it would be for a decision that would have such consequence that the repercussions were fully considered. One thing that we don't believe happened before this action was we don't believe that Congress was consulted. We don't believe that the so-called Group of Eight, the top congressional leaders and the leaders of the intelligence committees, were notified in advance that the United States was going to take this action. That's something that ordinarily would have happened at least moments before the U.S. took such decisive action in previous administrations, not in this administration. And, you know, the reaction you hear in Washington is there are essentially no defenders of Soleimani. There's no one who says here was a good man who didn't deserve to die. But there are questions raised about whether this action was proportionate and whether it was provocative in a way that will rebound to put Americans in harm's way. And when you see that alert from the State Department, it certainly sounds as though that part of the world is going to be a very dangerous place for Americans, and probably not only Iraq. You know, you look elsewhere in the region, you could see if you're going to see retribution taken by the Iranians, it could take place other places in the region where Americans gather.
Jack Beatty, briefly, I want to play for you a clip of Brett McGurk. He was a special envoy on ISIS under Presidents Obama and Trump. He served as a diplomat in Iraq and Afghanistan for the George W. Bush administration, quit the Trump administration over Syria. He gave a very sober outlook to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow about the situation in Iran.
I think we need to presume now, as a country, like it or not, we need to presume that we are in a state of war with Iran. This has been a covert war, a shadow war for 40 years. But with this action, I think we need to presume, to protect our people in the region, to protect our interests, that we're in a state of war with Iran. And that is not something that the Trump administration appears to have been prepared for.
Jack Beatty, you know, you thought about the political scene a long time and the questions of conflict abroad. What is your sense about what war means now, or and how ominous does this strike you as being?
Well, it's very ominous. I mean, the Trump policy of maximum pressure has led not to negotiations, but maximum peril. Before the election, before the 2016 election, a group of Republican strategists and former national security officials and Republican administrations published a letter warning of Trump's election. They singled out two things: his impulsivity and his ignorance. His ignorance of foreign affairs, his ignorance of military strategic issues, and his nature. I think we see both of them. The ignorance and the impulsivity at work here. The impulsivity, strike at this guy without thinking about the consequences, which are incalculable, and in no scale are they positive for the United States. And that indicates too that just the lack of thought about what's to come.
We'll be picking this up a little bit. We're talking about the death of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and what the Trump administration's plan might be going forward. Plus, we'll talk about the impeachment trial that looms for President Trump in the Senate. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. While President Trump campaigned on ending the war in Afghanistan, he's now confronted with the possibility of direct military confrontation with Iran, a possible precursor to more open war. At the same time, he's fighting for his own political future at home. As the new year looks like, there will be a Senate impeachment trial against him, and there certainly will be a campaign for re-election. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a super sharp panel of guests with me this hour: Susan Page of USA Today, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Susan Page, how do I say this? You know, there's this thing on the Twitters in which people say, you know, there's a quote for everything when it comes to this president, right? And the quotes mean there's a quote for Donald Trump in civilian, pre-presidential, pre-political life that seems to raise questions about the decisions he's making in the moment. Back in November 2011, then-citizen Donald Trump said he thought President Obama would start a war with Iran in the months leading up to his general re-election fight.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate. He's weak and he's ineffective. We have a real problem in the White House. So I believe that he will attack Iran sometime prior to the election because he thinks that's the only way he can get elected. Isn't it pathetic?
Susan, you and I were covering, elements of the Lewinsky scandal back in 98 when President Clinton ordered strikes in Sudan against a site where it was believed bin Laden would be heading. People thought it was Wag the Dog, a distraction. And yet, you know, it turned out bin Laden was a grave threat to American soil. The Dispatch, which is the new conservative publication of Stephen Hayes and Jonah Goldberg, reports this morning, you know, seemingly relying on inside officials that this was something that was carefully thought out and carefully plotted and calibrated almost reluctantly by President Trump. How do we assess what the president does? The president is in political peril of his life right now, right? And he's taken this very seemingly major deadly action. How do we assess all these things at the same time?
You know, I think one thing we should do, and we have to learn this lesson over and over again, is not assume we know everything at the start that we're going to know at the finish. There's a lot we don't know today about the decision behind this strike. We don't know. Secretary Pompeo said this morning on CNN that it was based on live intelligence analysis that said there was an imminent threat that would kill Americans. So by the time they will come a time when we know much more about whether that's true and what exactly the intelligence was telling us and what the imminent threat might be. We'll also be in a better position to assess the consequences of the action. You know, if you were looking at this now, and I'd be interested in what David Ignatius thinks about this, you might say this is the most consequential foreign policy decision, the foreign policy and national security decision that President Trump has made since he was inaugurated. But we don't actually know that that's true. We won't know that until this story has unfolded and that repercussions have unfolded in a fuller way. So I think it's always smart to keep in mind the limits of what we know at the moment. We do know, however, how President Trump has handled big decisions in the past, and he's often acted impulsively. He's a president who really trusts his gut. We've seen that with his policy toward North Korea, which has broken a lot of new ground that previous presidents had declined to break. So I think a little modesty is often called for on
David
our
Ignatius,
part.
Yeah, yeah. No, I appreciate that. David Ignatius, weigh in here.
My initial reaction last night as the news broke and I was trying to think of what to say just on Twitter because I thought people might be curious about first reactions was that I just had this eerie recollection of what 2003 felt like when the United mm-hmm. States invaded Iraq to kill an unquestionably brutal mass murderer, Saddam Hussein. Man had used chemical weapons against his own people and against others, a man who governed by torture. And here was the United States invading Iraq to try to get rid of him. We entered a series of unintended consequences, knock-on effects that we couldn't begin to understand or deal with adequately. And that action, which I think most people looking back would say was a mistake, really changed the course of our modern history. And the eerie feeling is that this assassination of the most powerful military leader of Iran has plunged us into a new set of unanticipatable, unknown consequences and linkages that will take us to a different place. And there may have been tactical planning for this. Certainly, they've flown in additional Marines and other troops. They've thought about evacuating people, but. We're talking about much greater consequences than getting a few hundred people in or out. Iran has been a deadly adversary of the United States since 1979. If you're my age, you have searing images of the Iranian siege of our embassy in Tehran. I have to admit those images were animated by seeing the Shia militiamen try to batter down the glass of the barricade mm-hmm. where an American guard was standing, you know, whoomp, whoomp, with that battering ram. It just took me right back to Tehran 1979, the sense of rage. We are entering again that house of pain, forgive me for using that phrase, I think without having a clear sense of where we're going. And in these situations, the one thing I've learned is to not overpredict as a journalist, to be skeptical about every assertion that people make. You know, if somebody says, "I smell flowers, look for the funeral." I think that's the proper role for us, and to ask as many questions as we can about what strategic ideas are there. The Secretary of State Pompeo has a visceral feeling about Iran. You know, when he talks, subject that makes him red in the face when he talks about Qasem Soleimani, when he talks about the vulnerability of American embassies. Remember, this is a man who made his career before becoming Secretary of State by leading the charge on Benghazi when he saw as a terrible dereliction of duty by the Obama administration and letting Americans die at that embassy. And clearly, he was not going to be part of any repetition of that. So he's taking this unusual action. As much as they think they've thought it through, there are 100 things they haven't thought about because you can't anticipate them. It's not possible. One step at a time, and for people like me and our other panelists, I think being skeptical, really testing propositions, not thinking we know the answers when we don't.
Jack Beatty, I want to turn now to the question of the president's political situation at home, which is not minor. It's dire. He's obviously we can talk about Democrats in a few minutes, but right now he's also facing the question of a Senate impeachment trial. So far, the trial hasn't moved forward. Republican leaders in the Senate are trying to keep impeachment proceedings to a minimum. President Trump says, "Hey, I'm open to this." And we're going to play a clip in which he talks about a unanimous vote on impeachment. I want to be clear to listeners. He's only talking about Republicans in the House of Representatives, not the Democrat whose vote led to strong margin impeaching him.
"I don't really care. It doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, I'd be very happy with the trial because we did nothing wrong. We didn't even have a witness and we won 196 to nothing. Okay, we didn't have a witness. That was all the Democrats' witness. Look, Adam Schiff is a corrupt politician. He's corrupt."
Again, there were 230 votes in the House of Representatives to impeach the president on at least one count, a significant margin. Almost all Democrats and independent Justin Amash of Michigan voted for a former Republican. Jack Beatty, how does the president's stance toward impeachment at this moment reflect the reality that he confronts?
Well, he's denying it. He's denying any basis, legitimate basis for the impeachment. The transcript was perfect, he says. And, of course, the Democrats say the transcript itself is prima facie evidence for abuse of power, the first article of impeachment. This week has not been a good one for the president in terms of leaks. The New York Times had a big story about how in July and August, one after the other, the national security team of the president came to him and told him, "Free up the military aid to Ukraine. You can't do this. This is not wise. We have national interests on the other side of this." In vain, they didn't listen to Pompeo or Esper or Bolton. And then we just got the week ended with an unredacted email, this through a website from the Pentagon, between emails between the Pentagon and OMB and an OMB official right out saying that we're going to hold the aid because POTUS wants it, essentially.
Right, right.
These are, you know. There it is. I mean, there his mayor, you know, what did Ambassador Sondland said, everybody is in the loop. Well, they were, and they were telling him with one voice, don't do this. Release that aid. The Pentagon people were worried about outright illegality in withholding the funds, which had been appropriated by Congress. And there is an impoundment act or something like that that says you can't do that. If Congress appropriates money, unless you have a good reason, you can't. Hold it up. So this has not been a good week in terms of the document and leak, the leaking in the documents. And it raises, you know, it makes sort of equivocations like Susan Collins. Well, yes, maybe we should have witnesses, but, you know, before we have witnesses, we have to see who the witnesses need to be and what the documents. We know who the witnesses need to be. Pompeo, Bolton, the others, Mulvaney, who was crucially involved, and we know what the documents are. So it's not been a good week in that regard for the president.
And credit where credit's due, the reporting on the email from the administration budget official who said this is really at POTUS's behest, and also the subsequent emails you talk about, the Pentagon people saying, have you run this by the lawyers yet? This was done by Kate Brannon of Just Security. She's the editorial director of that news site. Susan Page, I want to turn to you for a moment and play you this clip from Rudy Giuliani, obviously the president's personal attorney. He took questions from reporters for attending the president's New Year's party at Mar-a-Lago, which, of course, is owned by the president. He told reporters he found damning evidence against Democrats on his recent trip to Ukraine. Giuliani said he'd reveal information later in an inappropriate forum and even said he'd be willing to testify in the Senate impeachment trial.
I believe that historically, this impeachment will not be called an impeachment. I believe it will be called an illegal coup. I think it will go down in history to disgrace Nancy Pelosi and Schiff. There's never been a partisan impeachment. There's never been an impeachment based on something that isn't a crime. There's never been an impeachment that was put through with no witnesses being allowed, no lawyers being allowed, threatening to put people in jail. Many people are too young to remember the McCarthy era. But Schiff and Pelosi have done a reign of terror like Joseph R. McCarthy. And they're going to go down in history like him when people calm down and watch this carefully.
Now, Susan Page, as well as your day job as being the Washington bureau chief for USA Today, you're writing a forthcoming biography on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. I know enough about authors not to ask how the book's coming, but I do want to ask two things of you. First off, about the characterization you've just heard from the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. He compares House Speaker Pelosi, as well as Adam Schiff, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, as you know, basically instigating a reign of terror like Joseph R. McCarthy. How fair is that to what you've seen as a journalist and a chronicler, both of news in Washington and of the Pelosi's tenure?
You know, there you can certainly criticize the course that Nancy Pelosi has taken on impeachment, on her relationship with President Trump, which has been a really interesting one since Democrats won control of the House. But I do not think this characterization is a fair one. That is based on a reading of history. And as a matter of fact, Nancy Pelosi was the bulwark against impeachment as increasing numbers of House Democrats and Democrats generally were calling for the president's impeachment. Her view on impeachment turned only with the disclosure of the phone call the president made on July 25th with the president of Ukraine. We all have become so familiar with this, in which he seemed to be demanding a quid pro quo to get release of military aid and to have an Oval Office meeting that the Ukrainian president very much wanted for announcing the investigation of his political rival, Joe Biden. It was only at that point that Nancy Pelosi opened the door to Democrats impeaching the president. And she, in fact, has been pretty careful to keep the parameters of the impeachment narrow, not broad. There are many Democrats who wanted to impeach the president for many, many things. She kept the focus on strictly this question of Ukraine. So I don't think that that Mayor Giuliani's characterization is correct. Giuliani has offered to testify, to make speeches. He's offered to act as the prosecutor or the defendant, as the president's lawyer in the impeachment trial. We would all be in favor, I think, of a chance to hear Rudy Giuliani answer questions about his role in this affair under oath, because Rudy Giuliani is right at the center of the story of the president's relationship with Ukraine, which has led us to this point.
And Susan, I want to take advantage of you here talking about the fact that we don't currently have the articles of impeachment handed across to the other side of Congress yet, from the House, from Nancy Pelosi's office to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office, to allow the trial to start. You're seeing it seems as though there's been this high-stakes game of chicken in some way. You're also seeing some Republican allies of the president, maybe not in office, but some of his amplifiers say, well, you know, what impeachment? We've got an international crisis now. Let's put that in back burner. How carefully, how cleverly is she actually playing this? And is she doing it for more than just political gain?
Well, I think that she her decision to hold back on transmitting the articles of impeachment, which was, I've got to say, a surprise to me when she first raised the possibility an hour or so after the articles of impeachment were passed in the House, has given Chuck Schumer the gift of some time. You know, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, doesn't have many cards to play when it comes to trying to set the rules for the impeachment trial. You had the situation where Mitch McConnell said he was working hand in glove with the White House on impeachment. That raised some questions about whether he was going to act as a kind of impartial juror that the Constitution envisions. So this has been a way, I think, to give Chuck Schumer a chance to try to negotiate some of these rules and to allow some of these disclosures that Jack mentioned come out. That's been interesting, what we've heard so far. We don't know what we're going to hear going forward before the impeachment trial begins.
And there could be more revelations to come. We will no doubt discuss that in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, we're about to discuss the rise in anti-Semitism and hate crimes here in the U.S. with the latest, a violent attack at a rabbi's home during Hanukkah. Coming up, we'll also look at where the 2020 candidates stand in the polls and fundraising and who dropped out this week, a month before the Iowa caucuses. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, hundreds of homes have been destroyed and at least seven people are dead from wildfires off the eastern coast of Australia. People have been ordered to beaches and even the waters for safety. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is under attack for the government's response, and he's pleading for patience as angry residents demand more help. All this, as a new study suggests, the first demonstrable links between specific weather and global climate change. The Trump administration announced its long-awaited regulations on e-cigarettes or vaping. The FDA banned flavored vaping cartridges but will still allow tobacco and menthol e-cigarettes. That falls short of earlier promises by the White House and greatly eases industry concerns. Public health advocates say it just doesn't go far enough to curb youth vaping. And political figures are hailing a civil rights hero and a fixture in the U.S. House of Representatives. Atlanta's John Lewis announced this week he's battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Medically, the diagnosis is dire. The prognosis is dire. But Lewis said in a statement he'll undergo treatment and miss just a few votes. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have, as we have had all hour, a top-notch panel of guests with me. Susan Page of USA Today, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie. The Washington Post is reporting that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Minority Leader Charles Schumer, the top Republicans and Democrat in the Senate, are scheduled to deliver floor speeches today to address the impasse over the scope and timing of the impeachment trial of President Trump. That will, of course, be something we'll be watching as well. I do want to move on, however, Jack Beattie, to the 2020 race. The Democrats like Republicans, but Democrats are nonetheless showing enthusiasm. This was a field that was derided by a lot of Republicans, and there were concerns about whether or not this would generate great passions. But you know, the numbers are impressive. You have Bernie Sanders raising $34.5 million in the fourth quarter this year. You have Pete Buttigieg, South Bend, Indiana mayor, took in nearly $25 million. Andrew Yang took $16.5 million. And other Democrats raised money as well. It seems as though there remains interest in and enthusiasm for the Democratic field, even as it's not clear yet precisely who the leader is going to be.
That's right. I mean, the 14 Democratic candidates collectively got more than double what the president got in the last quarter, 14 versus one, but they got more than double. So that argues for a tremendous financial momentum behind some of these Democratic candidates. On the other hand, when you look at how Mr. Trump has used impeachment to draw contributions, it looks more like a draw. Consider this: on September 23rd, the day before Nancy Pelosi announced impeachment, they were going to go for impeachment, the president and his committee raised $50,000. The next day, when she announced it, $355,000. The next day, September 25th, $335,000. And on September 26th, just 3 days after she announced, Pelosi announced impeachment, $400,000 on the one day. That's that argues that the president has tremendous financial resources as well, mining the impeachment.
Susan Page, has the political press, has the establishment, have the pundits sort of underestimated Bernie Sanders as a serious player in this race?
Yes, I think so. And I think that's a mistake that we made last time around, too, when we thought there was no way he would be a serious challenger to Hillary Clinton for the nomination. He turned out to be a surprisingly formidable one. He started out a year. If you look at the polls a year ago, Biden was first, Sanders was second. You look at the polls today, Biden is first, Sanders is second. And if you look at the money numbers, and particularly look at the number of individual contributions that they each have, Sanders is way ahead. And what this tells us is his supporter is rock solid. They're not going to go anywhere. He's not going to go anywhere. And he's going to have the money to keep in this race as long as he chooses to do so. In fact, you mentioned how much money many of the candidates have, the top five candidates for sure. One thing that seems to guarantee is a long race, because the reason that candidates generally drop out of the presidential race is because they run out of money and they don't have a choice. We may have several candidates who have the choice to stay in as long as they want. Bernie Sanders is definitely going to be one of them.
David Ignatius, this is a moment at which one might look to leading Democratic candidates and say, okay, well, what's your vision for how we address things like the possible confrontation with Iran, right? We heard a little bit from Joe Biden last night by statement, awfully quiet on the Democratic front. What would you look for from a Bernie Sanders on such matters? What would you look for from a Democrat in opposition to Donald Trump? Or is there a rallying around at a time of crisis, as has historically been the kind of thing that that American political figures kind of wanted to at least be perceived as doing?
Well, Trump seems to break the mold on many things, and he's not a man who's easy for his opponents to rally around. So we'll see. I'm struck before the last night's assassination of Qasem Soleimani, you would have said that Donald Trump's hope entering 2020 was that he would run for re-election basically on a platform of peace and prosperity, that he had been surprisingly restrained in dealing with Iran. They had attacked generally. He had resisted retaliation. A lot of bluster towards North Korea, but no shooting war, and indeed not much real in the, on the negotiating front either. And an economy that keeps chugging along and seems to shrug off problems. Both those elements are at least now enclosed in question marks. Financial markets and oil markets have been very unsteady today. And if we move into real conflict, and this could be a global set of retaliatory actions by Iran, I'm sure there'll be financial consequences. And an American president who wanted to get us out of wars in the Middle East will be smack in the middle of what could be the biggest of all. So I'm struck by how suddenly things have changed. The conventional wisdom is that Joe Biden, who's been vice president for 8 years, who knows national security, seasoned hand, is somebody that people might turn to. We'll see if Biden has the ability to convey steadiness, clarity to a country that's going to be nervous if things go south in a hurry. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, a lot of candidates to the left of Biden will say, see, this, you know, the era of endless wars continues, and this is a reason to get me elected. I don't know that they'll be seen as people who can manage a very volatile world. But again, that's what the campaign is to test. But I think the political implications of what happened last night, we're just beginning to think about, play out as we see what the real actions by the parties are. But I think they'll be significant.
Susan Page, before we move on a little bit, I do want to acknowledge the candidate Julian Castro has dropped out of the race. I believe there are 14 notable Democrats still in the race. He made a pitch on a number of levels. He didn't gather a great deal of support in the polls, but he seems to have, as Ryan Lizza pointed out last night, that Castro, you know, seemed to have influenced the policy of Elizabeth Warren and then others in terms of immigration at the border. And he also called for Democrats to figure out rules that would be more inclusive, ensuring candidates of color remain. Andrew Yang, you know, is still in the race. Obviously, an Asian American entrepreneur there. It seems to have not only real money but a lot of support. The Yang Gang out there getting some momentum there. What does Castro's candidacy and withdrawal say to us about the state of the Democratic field and about the ability of candidates to make an impact there?
You know, I think disappointing to people, some Democrats who had hoped for a fully diverse field that reflects kind of the coalition that elects Democrats. Julian Castro was the only Latino in the field. You know, he didn't run a terrible race. He influenced the debate, as you said, especially on issues of immigration. And he, I think, got high marks for his performance in the debates. I think he's out of the race for president. He's not off the stage entirely. He is certainly would be, I think, on the list of possible running mates, depending on who the presidential nominee turns out to be. Or, you know, certainly he could be a cabinet secretary in a Democratic administration if there was one. But it does make the field less diverse. And, you know, concern about the field that will be on stage at the next Democratic debate on January 14th, because while Andrew Yang made the stage, Cory Booker did not. Kamala Harris has dropped out of the race. So it's not the kind of diverse set of choices that I think some Democrats had hoped they would have.
Exactly right. I want to turn now to you know, as though we don't have enough nightmares to think about abroad, I do want to turn to David Ignatius to the Pacific and what lies over there, and talk about North Korea. President Trump, before a New Year's party at his Mar-a-Lago resort, addressed threats made by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who announced his country should be able to continue nuclear testing because of continued sanctions brought by the U.S. against his nation. Trump downplayed the threats. Here's what he said.
I have a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un. I know he's sending out certain messages about Christmas presents, and I hope his Christmas present is a beautiful vase. That's what I'd like, a vase.
You think it will be, sir?
As opposed to something else. I don't know. Look, he likes me. I like him. We get along. He's representing his country. I'm representing my country. We have to do what we have to do. But he did sign a contract. He did sign an agreement talking about denuclearization.
David Ignatius, as the pitching coach in the movie Bull Durham, said, you know, champagne flutes often make a nice gift. But in terms of what Trump is saying substantively here, you know, he's talking about a contract being signed. I think he's saying the agreement. My recollection was the agreement that was signed on nuclear – question of nuclear weapons in Korea didn't bind anybody to too much. What is the state of play there, and what is the consequence or the meaning of what Kim Jong-un actually said.
You'd have to say that was the worst drafted contract in diplomatic history. And I think President Trump just expressed the essence of his Korea policy. He likes me. I like him. And he always comes back to this idea that his personal relationship is so wonderful it'll surmount every other factor. The truth is that in this New Year's Day speech where Kim essentially said he felt now free to resume testing of missiles and other weapons, he has over 2 years come full circle. It was in his New Year's Day address in 2018 that he basically turned course and said, we've advanced far enough that we're ready to turn now toward diplomacy. He signaled all sorts of ways he wanted to engage the United States. And Trump, I think, was smart enough to take him up on it. I'm not a critic of his efforts to have this diplomatic engagement with North Korea. It's just it hasn't led anywhere because of the lack of clarity about what the nominal commitment to complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula actually means. The U.S. has tried very hard to have working groups to discuss that, to discuss a phased process. Gotten nowhere, basically, over those 2 years. And so that's the problem that we face. And Trump, I think, was counting when this process started on help from China. China would be a partner in coaxing North Korea towards something more stable. That hasn't happened either, and indeed the relationship with China is much more fraught today than it was when Trump took office. So as much as we're worried about the Middle East and Iran, get ready for some event. Kim will look at what's going on and will say, ha, perfect time to destabilize the United States further with my claims. So it's going to be a hot winter of 2020.
And Jack Beatty, as we close out this hour, last several minutes we have, I want to acknowledge hate crimes that have occurred. And there have been a couple of them in a couple of different ways. But first to focus, outside the suburbs of New York, there was this machete-wielding man. His family says that he's mentally ill, but the governor and others, federal charges have been filed saying this was a hate crime, five being stabbed and slashed at the home of a rabbi during Hanukkah. It seems as though it was a targeted attack, that searches showed that he was searching for a Jewish site to go out. And there's been a seeming spike in openly anti-Semitic acts, even here in the New York area, which has been known as a haven for Jews, you know, one of the largest centers for Jewish people in the world. What do you make of what you've seen and the response to it?
Well, the response has been heartening, I think. On Saturday, there's going to be a march of solidarity with New York Jews, and that's very, very important. And the governor and the mayor are leading that. What I've been disturbed with is to read that 2/3 of the attacks perpetrated in the city have been by city juveniles, that is, people in the city schools. And that really should give us pause. Are these schools teaching? For example, in the Boston schools, there's a curriculum called Facing History in Ourselves, which is a curriculum around the Holocaust and around genocide and the persecution of races and peoples throughout history. Surely those young people need to learn these things, and it's just frightening to think that they that this kind of thing is going on. And on the other side, you know, the governor said domestic terrorism. Is it really domestic terrorism when a schizophrenic man who's clearly involved in anti-Semitic rumination commits an atrocity? It looks much more like, as his pastor said, a case of what are we doing about schizophrenic people? Is it time to re-examine this whole deinstitutionalization that many people think was founded on bad evidence, this book that charges that, and that allows people to essentially, as the pastor for this man said, go home. The message to such people is go home and tell us if something happens.
And yet,
we have to do better than that.
And yet others ascribe a more ideological point to that. That final note from Jack Beatty on Points News Analyst. Jack, thanks as always.
Thank you.
We've also been joined by Susan Page. She's Washington bureau chief and author of forthcoming biography of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Susan, thanks for being on the show today.
Hey, my pleasure, David. Thank you.
And I want to thank David Ignatius of The Washington Post, a wise voice. Delighted to have you with us this hour.
Good to be with you. Thank you, David.
Continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.